May approach. And Ms. Klein, you are here also.
Yes, sir.
Do either council have any questions before we begin State versus Madison?
I do not, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Very good. Then, Mr. Wilson, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel for the state. My name's Mike Wilson. I represent the defendant in this matter, Dale Madison. He's raised 8 assignments of error. I'm going to be focusing on assignment of error 2 first. We also have assignment of error 1, which may come up naturally as we're discussing assignment of error 2. The question presented by assignment of error 2 is whether ZM exercised her own free will when over 2 months after Mr. Madison suggested they have sex, ZM, by herself, drove to a supermarket. She purchased a bottle of allergy medication. She walked out of the supermarket, got in her car, started her car, drove to a different location, a quiet location. She, at that time, at some point thereafter, took a large overdose of this medication. And then tragically, she waited to die there. It's tragic, but viewing this evidence, even in the light most favorable to the state, ZM's voluntary suicide was the cause in fact and the sole proximate cause of her death.
Does the statute actually require death?
The statute in question, in order to convict Mr. Madison of intentional child abuse resulting in death, requires that the child abuse result in a death. He was sentenced for intentional child abuse resulting in death. His sentence reflects a term commensurate with only that particular conviction.
Has our case law construed resulting in death to mean sole proximate cause of the death? I think those were your words, sole proximate cause. And I guess I don't know that they are anchored in our case law.
So if we go to the case law that this court has, you know, that we've seen in from this court on the matter of proximate or on the matter of causation, and I have it right here. And I'll ask you to rephrase that question, please, if you could. Are you suggesting solely as to the child abuse resulting in death statute, or are you just asking about proximate cause in general?
I am asking about the specific statute, and I understood you to say that there was some requirement that the death be the sole proximate cause, or that the child abuse be the sole proximate cause of the death. And
all right.
And I didn't understand. I want you to tell me where in our jurisprudence you find that proposition of law.
I'm applying the case law of this court going back.
Which
as far
cases?
I think everyone on this court hopefully agrees with me, this is a unique conviction in the history of our jurisprudence here in Nebraska. I couldn't find a case anywhere in the country where someone had been convicted of child abuse resulting in death when the victim commits a suicide months after the child abuse. Could not find one. So that leaves us...
What's the typical case?
What's that?
What's the typical factual scenario?
A typical, like a good hypothetical, in my opinion, would be, for instance, there have been situations where parents have put their child in an extremely hot bathtub, for instance, caused severe burns to the child that became affected, the child died. That, to me, would be intentional child abuse resulting in death. But to return to your question, Your Honor, since this is such a unique issue before the court, and the court has not yet interpreted the language results in the death of such child.
Well, have we not interpreted it? Haven't we said that it means proximate cause? The Murrow case, for example?
Your Honor, I think, yes, I don't have that one, I believe, in my brief, but I think I know what you're referring to.
Well, what do you contend it does mean then, resulting in death? Focusing on the text.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the facts of this case. What does the statute mean?
The statute means that the but for the child abuse, the victim's death would not have occurred.
Why isn't that a factual question for the jury?
It can be a factual question for the jury. There could be an instance where child abuse results. I gave an example of His Honor Justice Funk. That can happen. It is a factual question. This assignment of error number two is arguing that in this case, the state did not meet its burden.
Did you, that, during the trial, did the appellant argue that there was intervening circumstances that led to the death of this child?
I want to say yes. I mean, now I'll be honest, Your Honor. I did not actually represent the defendant at trial, so I'm basing my memory on the record.
Did you review the record?
I've reviewed the record, and yes, my understanding is there was argument made that the cause of the death of this child was a suicide, and that suicide happened outside the presence of my client, Mr. Madison.
Can you help me with the record? He pled guilty to attempted incest.
That's correct.
And then there's a jury trial on intentional child abuse resulting in death.
That's correct.
What was the jury's knowledge, if any, regarding the guilty plea of attempted incest?
Your Honor, the state admitted evidence of the conviction and the factual basis for the conviction before the jury.
Okay. So it may be not too presumptuous to assume they assumed there was a crime other than the one on trial.
Would you agree that the sufficiency question before us is whether the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the conviction, could a reasonable jury could find that the abuse that I believe is not disputed was the proximate cause of ZM's death? Is that the question?
That is a question, but causation has actually three potential elements if you look at the common law.
But for cause, mm-hmm. but that's all a part of proximate cause, correct?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
And correct. So what would you have us look at to answer that question? Isn't foreseeability a big element of proximate cause?
So that Justice Freudenberg has sort of gets back to what you asked, which is what was the jury there to decide, right? And one of the aspects of this analysis could be foreseeability. And I'm sorry I have to talk in these kind of abstract terms, but again, we're kind of charting new territory here with this particular offense. But if you go to foreseeability and we go to the evidence that was presented in this trial, the state's own witnesses disproved foreseeability. And the way they did that is they relayed the information the state asked them to relay, which was, is there a connection between sexual abuse and suicide? They asked the therapist, what's the connection between sexual abuse and suicide? What was her response?
I want to make sure that I think I understand where you're going.
Yeah.
I want to make sure to give you a chance to respond to what I think is a key part of this. There's prior abuse and a prior suicide attempt, correct? And don't we have to take that into account in analyzing foreseeability?
The evidence showed that ZM, when she was it would have been about 2015, that she took some medication of her mother's and told her mother immediately that she'd taken some medication. The young lady was taken directly to the hospital. That is evidence, and to the extent that this court considers it,
and
that's understandable.
It followed and was tied to prior abuse by Mr. Madison, correct? the first suicide attempt. There's at least testimony that there's this abuse. She sees Mr. Madison. She has the first suicide attempt. And then there's even evidence that the mother tells Mr. Madison that the reason for the suicide attempt was the sexual abuse. Correct? And doesn't that factor into the foreseeability analysis, what's happened before? If it's happened before, it's foreseeable that it might happen again?
That's the state's argument. And that's, and
I want to give you a chance to respond.
Yeah, and I do want to respond to it. I'd like to respond during my rebuttal time.
I think you're out.
Oh, that's my full time. That went really fast. Your Honor, I think this is the way I'd respond to that. This is one aspect of the evidence. The state introduced a great deal of other evidence that absolutely counters the proposition that a voluntary suicide is something that is foreseeable based solely on an abusive act that occurs months prior.
Isn't that the role of the jury, though, to decide what evidence they believe?
Your Honor, it is the role of the jury. It is the role of the jury to do that. But the jury also has to make rational findings. And when you have every bit of evidence running contrary, I understand.
We're not saying every bit of the evidence. But you just said there was some evidence of prior abuse and a prior attempt at suicide. Mm-hmm. And then there's some evidence that suicides don't necessarily lead to, or abuse doesn't lead to suicide. Mm-hmm. So there's contradictory evidence on both sides. And doesn't the role of the jury has to weigh that evidence? Are you asking us to find that the jury was clearly wrong in doing so?
The jury was not clearly wrong in weighing the evidence. The jury was that the finding of fact that this abuse was a direct or proximate cause or cause in fact of a suicide that occurs over 2 months following the abuse ran contrary to the evidence the state presented, even viewing it in the light most favorable to the state.
Are you saying this as an evidentiary matter in this case, or are you saying that could never, that incest could never in a death under that statute?
I would never suggest that to this court. I'm asking for a narrow holding here. Your Honors, that situation could occur. Certainly, if you had a situation where a defendant had somebody trapped in a place where they couldn't escape and they saw suicide as their only way out, that's a very different scenario. But what we have here, as the evidence showed, Your Honors, the undisputed evidence was that that is not the scenario we had here. We had a scenario where this young lady, again, tragically, but she had plenty of time and distance from this incident. Plenty. And ultimately...
So your position would be different if the suicide would have been immediate?
If it had happened in a situation where a jury could reasonably find...
No, let's talk hypothetically.
Yeah.
The second sexual abuse situation occurs, the incest, the attempt to incest, mm-hmm. and there's an immediate attempt to suicide following. Would your position be different?
It depends on how immediate and under what circumstances. That,
hours afterwards.
Okay. In that scenario, the argument would be stronger, Your Honor. It would be stronger that conviction could be upheld. I'd argue it's stronger in that scenario because, you know, the circumstances show not just foreseeability, but they also show a direct line.
Well, to be too simple here, you're just saying state didn't prove causation.
That's the basics, Your Honor, on assignment of error too.
Thank you.
Chief, if I could ask one more question.
You may.
You reference the different elements within proximate cause, mm-hmm. cause in fact, but mm-hmm. for. Mm-hmm. I understand you to be arguing the proximate cause portion of that. Are you also disputing that there was a lack of evidence that the abuse was a but-for cause of the suicide?
Yes.
Or do you're disputing that as well?
Yes, I'm disputing all of those elements.
And what's the argument that there's no evidence that but for the abuse, she would have committed suicide anyway?
So The lack of evidence comes from a few different sources here, but number one, the state introduced evidence directly refuting the state's theory that this was a direct, that but for the abuse, ZM would not have committed suicide. They introduced the evidence, Your Honor. They introduced it, and ultimately, a rational trier fact, even viewing the evidence in the light most favorable, when they hear three government witnesses say, no, there's no connection. There isn't a connection between this child abuse, sexual abuse, or just child abuse, however you want to put it. There's no connection between that and then an involuntary, like a compulsion to complete an act of suicide. And that's key here, Your Honors. We have a completed act of suicide here. We don't have suicide. I mean, yeah, sure, there was suicidal ideation. That happens. And they did say that can be a result, but they also said there's a difference between suicidal ideation and a completed act of suicide. And then their own detective said he'd been doing this for 25 years. He'd investigated 1,000 cases, and this was the first one where someone committed suicide. So if foreseeability is an issue here, Your Honors, as you're debating this case, I ask you to consider the state's own evidence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. If you parse out the facts of this as sparsely as the defendant wants to, then you might have a question whether or not this was proximate cause. But if you look at the facts as a whole, as they were presented to the jury, it's clear that there was that the defendant's sexual abuse was the proximate cause of the victim's death by suicide. The defendant was convicted of child abuse resulting in death, which requires that the defendant knowingly and intentionally place a child in a situation that endangers her life, her physical health, or her mental health. And normally I don't do this, but I'm going to take a couple minutes and go through the facts as they were presented, which, because it's a proximate cause thing, you have to rely on the facts. Defendants, or the victim's parents split up in 2013. Late 2014, she decided she wanted to try and reestablish contact with her dad, so they made some visitation attempts. After the second one, she came home crying, told her mother that her dad was abusing her while she was asleep. Her mom immediately got her into counseling, and in 2005 she was referred to CAC for an interview. 2006, the defendant had continued counseling.
2016.
Pardon me?
2016.
Yes, I beg your pardon, 2016. She continued counseling till November of 2016 when she decided she didn't need it anymore, but then around Christmas the defendant texted and said, I've got some presents for the girls. Will you come and get them? Victim inadvisedly went along with her mother, stayed in the car but made eye contact with her dad, and that was all it took to send her into a downward spiral of behavior and depression. In February of 2017, she walked into her mom's room, tossed a bottle of pills on the bed, said, I just took a couple handfuls of your prescription because I want to commit suicide. She was, of course, immediately rushed to the hospital. She was actually EPC'd to Richard Young. And while she was still in the hospital, her mother called the defendant and told him exactly what had happened and why. It was his sexual abuse had sent her into a spiral of depression such that she had attempted suicide. And she made sure the defendant knew that it was the result of his sexual abuse. In 2019, the victim said inadvisedly that she wanted to try and reestablish some sort of relationship with her dad. Her mom warned her against it, said, this is a dangerous thing. She said, I've been going to counseling. I think I can handle it. So they started, again, some tentative visitations. And in mid-July of 2019, everything went bad. She was at her dad's house and was basically looking at her phone, not doing much of anything, when her father walks out stark naked out of the bathroom, presents himself directly in front of her so that she was fully aware of that fact, and began telling her that they should have sex because it would bring them closer and that the police don't have any business telling fathers and daughters they shouldn't do that and God thinks it's okay. She basically, as most people would, kind of freaked out and flipped out. There was a controlled phone call. She went home and immediately told her mother about it, and mom got her calmed down. And a couple days later, a controlled phone call was made wherein the defendant essentially admitted saying that he had wanted to have sex with her. He was arrested, and in a phone call he made to his father after his arrest, the officer heard the defendant's side of the phone call saying, well, I made some, I think he said, he had an unfortunate conversation with his daughter and that he had crossed a line and he was going to have to pay for it. After this incident, the victim's condition just simply spirals out of control and it down badly and quickly. September 5th, she told her mom that she needed to go back to the hospital because she was having suicidal ideations because she couldn't get the image of her naked father out of her head. She was in fact sent back to Richard Young. She was discharged September 9th, but victim said, it didn't help me the way it did the first time. I'm still a mess. Her behavior deteriorated radically over the next week or so. And on the last day her mom saw her alive, the victim just suddenly leaped up with her fists clenched and she was shaking badly. And her mom found a note said, I'm with my boyfriend and then I'm going to write in my journal. And in fact, shortly thereafter, she was found dead in her vehicle from an overdose of an over-the-counter medication. There is essentially a direct line that can be drawn from the defendant's sexual abuse to her death by suicide, because in all the years of counseling that she went to, the only stressor she ever said that made her suicidal was the sexual abuse inflicted on her by her father. That's the only thing she ever said. Yeah, there was some discussion of, you know, boyfriend troubles, that kind of thing, but the only thing that actually made her want to end her own life was the sexual abuse inflicted on her by her father. That is a proximate cause. And this court has repeatedly held that proximate cause in the criminal context simply has to be a cause, not the cause. And this is absolutely a cause of her death by suicide. She was placed in a situation deliberately by her father where he knew that she had attempted suicide before because of his sexual abuse, and he did it again. That's intentional child abuse, which resulted in her death.
What effect does the passage of time have, as argued by the appellant, between the incident of attempted incest and the actual suicide?
In this case, it was about, 60 days. I don't think it has that much because of the fact she tried to get herself put back together. It didn't work. And again, the only thing she ever said was, I can't get the image of my naked father out of my head. It's making me crazy, literally making me crazy. I can't deal with it anymore.
Well, is the passage of time really about mental health or the actual suicide?
Not completely sure I understand your question, sir.
Well, the whole foreseeability here, does that really have to do with the death itself, or is the foreseeability mental health problems? The way the statute reads, causes or permits a minor child to be placed in a situation that endangers his or her life or physical or mental health. And then it goes on to...
I think it endangered both life and mental health. It's ultimately mental health is what led to her ending her life. But the last incident was completely intentional because he knew she had attempted to commit suicide as a result of this very same activity before. So there's really no other explanation for what he did. And he knew that she had mental issues as a result of his prior sexual abuse, and he engaged in it again. She did her best to deal with it it wasn't good enough. She just simply didn't have the strength or the wherewithal to be able to face this on what appeared to be a continuing basis, and she saw no other option other than to end her life, so she did.
So is there some point in time after which we would say the causal connection is broken?
I think eventually at some point in time there would have to be. I think it would have to be somewhat more than just the passage of time, though. If she had been, if after the second incident, say she had gone to counseling and said, I'm okay, I'm dealing with this, things are good, and then she had committed suicide, I think then we might be dealing with something different within those 60 days. But the 60 days that lapsed from the time of the offense to the time of her death was simply nothing more than a battle for survival for her.
Suppose the hypothetical where the exposure occurs, the mental health treatment process begins and continues for 10 years, and then it ultimately is unsuccessful in preventing the suicide. Would under those circumstances, would a conviction stand?
Possibly. If you can.
Is that a question for the jury?
That would be a question for the jury. And I think I cited, I believe it was an Alabama case, or no, it was an Indiana case, where it's not a criminal case, but somebody had planted an explosive in a backpack that exploded and injured a couple that just happened to be walking by. I think it was quite some time, 4 years, I think, after the incident that the gentleman ultimately committed suicide as a result of the pain and suffering he suffered as a result of that. And they said, if it's an intentional tort, this is an intentional act, then that person retains liability for it if it is a factor in the ultimate demise of that person. So I think the answer is it could possibly be, the conviction could possibly still stand, depending on how you can tie it back to the original, or to the abuse.
Thank you. Remind me on the record that what is the testimony regarding her mental health between the attempted incest and the suicide?
Between the time of the last incident and her death?
Yeah.
She was a mess.
So says which who witnesses?
Her mother said she was an anxious mess. She wasn't eating. She wasn't sleeping. She was basically, part of the time she was, if she would talk to you at all, she'd snap at you. Most of the time she was isolating herself. She was showing basically classic signs of deep depression, and it just kept getting worse and worse, and she's no amount of counseling. She tried counseling. She went to Richard Young. It didn't help. She just
between that event of attempted incest and the suicide.
I'm sorry?
Between that event of the attempted suicide.
Yes.
And attempted incest.
Right.
And the suicide, she sought mental health counseling.
Yes, she did.
And the evidence of that treatment is in the record for the jury to hear.
It is.
Thank you.
It is. Unless there are further questions, we would ask that the judgment and conviction in this case be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have no time for rebuttal. There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, you are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Timothy L. Ashford, PC, LLO versus Roses. And Timothy L. Ashford, PC, LLO versus Tate.